So after a recent run of absolutely brilliant interviews, we've got another one for you this week. This time it's John Dee, founder and organiser of Rock Aid Armenia, Australian TV presenter, environmentalist, and back in the early 80s, the editor of Yes Music magazine, and his co-conspirator, Dave Watkinson, author, of course, of Perpetual Change, and John Anderson and the Warriors, The Road to Yes, recently published, and that's a great title indeed. So, hello, John.
Hey there, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And hello, Dave.
Hi there.
And Mark's with me as well. And we're here to discuss something amazing and unique, actually, in the history of Yes, or perhaps we should say a band which eventually morphed into Yes. But before we go into that, tell us about the Yes Music fanzine, John. What was it and how were you involved?
Well, basically, it was something I did when I was at school, and someone that Dave and I both knew decided to, I think he went to Polytechnic and said, you know, you run the school magazine. Have you ever thought about, you know, running a magazine about Yes, and I can introduce you to everyone? Which he did, so thank you, Barry. And before I knew it, I was suddenly, you know, this 17-year-old kid suddenly interviewing, you know, all the guys in Yes.
Right.
Meeting up with them, going to Alan White's, you know, wedding reception as an 18-year-old, and, you know, as we're going to talk about today, at 18, going with, you know, Dave, going down to see cinema playing. It was, you know, and rehearsing.
Yeah.
So it was a fantastic time in my life, because as a big Yes fan, I saw Yes for the first time in 1977. On the Going for the One tour as a 13-year-old. So
right.
To suddenly, you know, be writing about, you know, photographing and talking to your musical heroes, it was a great thing for me to do as a school kid. And that's how David and I met up. And, you know, I met people like Dougie Craig, Lou White, all, you know, there's so many well-known Yes fans who I met at that time.
Right.
And what's great about Yes is not the fact that the, you know, the band itself is going, which is wonderful, but that so many of us have these really long-term relationships that started out by all of us being Yes fans. And so that was my beginnings with Yes, was the Yes magazine, you know, the Yes Music magazine.
Yeah, and how long did it keep going for?
Look, I think we did about nine editions. They were quite hard to put together in those days. You know, these days, you know, you've got a computer and you can, you know, you can knock together that kind of thing really quickly and easily.
Mm.
But back in those days, this shows how old we are, right? So I was 18, so this would be like 1982. Mm. It was all kind of trying to get typesetting done was really expensive.
Mm.
Getting photos done and processed, you know, wasn't no such thing as a digital camera. Or you literally had to cut everything apart and glue it onto the page and then take a photograph of your artwork. It was a nightmare. So, you know, it would be a lot, you know, these days I would have done 100 of them for the same time it took me to do nine. It was, but it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, right. I can imagine. So, John, let's start at the beginning here. So who invited you to the cinema rehearsal, and how did you and David end up there?
Well, basically because I was running the Yes Music magazine, I was in touch with the band quite a lot at the time. So Chris Choir was the person who finally invited me down to it. And he and I were talking a lot over the phone at the time. You know, if you were a reader of the magazine, you know, Chris was a regular person who I interviewed at that time.
Mm.
I was also talking to Alan quite a bit too. And he was very keen for me to see the new band. And Nigel Libby was a friend of mine who lived quite nearby in Earl's Court. And so I arranged the date of the visit with him, because he was basically engineering the cinema rehearsals.
Mm.
And that session took place, if I remember rightly, at John Henry's rehearsal studios in London. It looked like a really big warehouse. And, you know, David was a close friend of mine. We first met when we went to see Yes playing at Deeside for the drama tour in 1980.
Right.
And so I knew he was a great photographer. And if you're going to go to something like that, you've got to take a good mate. And the fact he was a photographer too was a double benefit, you know. So, you know, if you're going to go to see a band that close up, you know, you've got to take a really close friend. So the fact that David was available to come down, it was great, both of us being there. And thankfully, we have David's photographs as evidence of what took place on that day.
So, Dave, then, you, you and John were the only members of the public who ever got to see cinema play live, I assume. How does that feel?
It feels really good, and it is true. We are the only two, and we got lucky, but at least we could document it. I mean, perhaps didn't realise what it was going to lead to. We certainly didn't. We knew what we were stood in front of was incredible, and wouldn't happen again, being within a couple of feet of everyone. With it wound up to 11, it was unbelievable. So, but we didn't quite realise the gigantic leap that it would take. So, yeah, lots of photos taken. It's nice those are used in official, as the unofficial cinema stuff. So I'm very proud of that. And, you know, thanks to John and the old magazines, they all worked a treat. And people like them. And, yeah, they're still good to look at.
Yeah.
I'm very proud. I'm proud, actually.
And what was interesting, you know, about it was that the guys were all playing on a very slightly raised platform, and they were quite keen for us to walk amongst them as they were playing.
Right.
So the equivalent really is like going to a Yes gig and just walking around on the stage, you know, and deciding, I'm going to stand next to the cymbal, right? You know, where, Alan might just really whack that really hard and right next to my face. It was quite a strange experience because, firstly, it was really loud.
Mm.
You're standing on the stage. So every time Chris Squire was kind of, you know, hitting a really deep bass note, you felt it in your feet and up through your body. That was quite incredible. And we, you know, as I said, we were walking around on stage, and the music sounded so powerful and so energetic.
Mm.
You know, we were trying to, you know, compose ourselves and take photographs, whilst at the same time just occasionally looking at each other and, you know, raising our eyebrows going, can you believe we're actually here and this is happening? It was the Yes fans' ultimate dream. It was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. So, John, can you actually just tell us the sort of sequence of events, when you got there, what you did, how you got in, all those sorts of things?
Yeah, so we're basically, David and I met up at Euston Station in London and went down together to John Henry's. And you know, initially we looked on the outside and thought, this can't be right. This looks basically like an old warehouse, and which I guess it was. It must have been converted into rehearsal studios. And I remember ringing the bell and said, John D from Yes Music. They said, yes, come on in. And so David and I went in there, and there were obviously a few different bands playing. So eventually we found our way into the cinema rehearsal rooms.
Hmm.
So people were kind of tuning up. Thankfully, Nigel Luby was there to welcome us. So that was good. So he was he was someone who I met quite a lot at that time. So it was kind of great. There's someone I know really well here, and it made us at home. I remember getting a cup of tea and then basically, you know, went and said hello to everybody. And I'd just been to Alan White's wedding reception just prior to this. So the nice thing that kind of made everything relax really nicely was I had the photographs from that wedding reception. And so Alan was really keen to see those, and everyone else was. And so that was the nice icebreaker that we had that it made the whole thing get off on a really nice footing.
Yeah.
And then basically Nigel, you know, got them to tune up. And if anyone's heard the bootleg that I recorded of the sessions, you can hear them tuning up. And then basically they started off with a song called Carry On, which was just amazing. And I guess we'll talk in detail about each track. But basically the tracks that were played were Carry On, then Make It Easy, then a really interesting song called Open Your Doors that was very different for the band, where Chris was on lead vocal. And in between each song, Tony Kaye was basically rehearsing the intro to Hearts, you know. Right. So you know that. So he was basically, you know, playing that almost all the time in between each full song that was played. Yeah. And it was really interesting hearing Tony's keyboard style, you know, where we've been so used to kind of the Rick Wakeman, Jeff Downes style, and then hearing, you know, Tony with his, you know, very rhythm-based, really fantastic Hammond organ. I mean, I think one of the things that was really amazing about the sessions was actually seeing Tony again, because of course a lot of Yes fans at that period, hadn't seen Tony, hadn't heard of Tony for many years. Mm. And to see him on Hammond, you forgot just how amazing a Hammond organ player Tony Kaye is. He was stunning to watch close up, as he still is. But that was one of my most exciting moments, was seeing Tony close up playing the keyboards. I don't know about you, David.
Yeah, I mean, my impressions were, I think we walked down the road and walked past Gary Moore. We just walked past us, didn't we, before we got in. And then we went in there.
As you do.
And they were all very chilled. It was all really relaxed. I remember that. And we ended up talking about bits and pieces that you'd taken in, and with some memorabilia and chats. It was all very laid back. And I asked Chris about some memorabilia and things, and he seemed to know everything in his really relaxed, chilled, laid back way, going, yeah, well, bit of this, bit of that. So he was very cool and laid back. So there was this actual calm of relaxation and right. atmosphere yeah. before the music started, when it was like, you know, 0 to 100.
Yeah.
There was such a huge change. And yeah, once they started the music and we could go freely anywhere we liked around them.
Yes.
They were completely into it. It was shocking, shockingly good. And yeah. It's kind of mind-blowing, really, yeah.
I have to say, you know, David was saying, you know, that Chris was laid back. It looked like he was actually dressed in his pyjamas. I think that was the only way they could get him to the studio on time. You know, yes. Fish was always late.
Yeah.
So I had actually, you know, turned up expecting us to wait for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
You know, for Chris to actually turn up, but he was already there in his pyjamas.
Yeah.
So I think that's how that must have been the trick to get him to the rehearsals on time.
Just in case, Dave, just in case anyone is listening to this and doesn't really know about cinema, just tell us who the band consisted of at this time and at this rehearsal.
Well, yes, Tony Kaye was managed to come back. And like John said, it was terrific to just stand there right next to the keyboard and blast away. Trevor Rabin was unbelievable, really. The ironic thing about seeing Trevor is I did see Trevor on his UK solo tour.
Ah.
And after the solo tour he did at the UK, I actually thought, you know what, this guy would be amazing for Yes. And this is well before cinema. That's another, but it was incredible to see him.
Yeah.
Alan has obviously been there and knows it all and done the whole lot. And then Chris, you know, the powerhouse that he is, if there ever was a powerhouse, it was that day there and then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have thoughts on, you know, the famous photograph I took and also the ending, the outcome of it all. But we'll get to that.
Yeah.
So a fresh lineup of Tony Kaye and Trevor.
Yeah.
Powerful, very powerful.
Okay then. Well, let's talk about the songs themselves then. Can you take us through each one of them and your thoughts on each song, John?
Yeah, well, look, Carry On was the first one, and that kicks off with this, you know, basically Alan calling everyone to action, and then launched into this great, straightforward drum beat. And so it starts just with the drums, and then everyone comes in one hit. And Carry On, really, for me, was undoubtedly my favorite track of the rehearsal. They were so tight, so powerful, and what was interesting was, I guess with Dave and I, we were kind of listening to it, and the first thing you're wanting to know is how similar to Yes is this, or is it going to be more like Asia? Because obviously Asia had great success by that point, and you know, and part of you was thinking, I hope there's still an element of Yes to this.
Mm.
And they don't go, you know, too commercial. And then you realize when you heard Chris's bass lines on this, you heard the power, you know, you heard the Yes rhythm section, basically. So that was still intact and was unbelievably powerful. Mm. And then, of course, you're thinking, well, is Trevor Rabin anywhere near as good as Steve Howe? And then you realize he had a very, very different technique, as we now all know. Because bear in mind, this is the first time anyone had seen Trevor Rabin with Yes guys, you know, so we had no previous knowledge as to how would he fit in with these guys, and he was just amazingly powerful. And then, of course, the great thing with Carry On was seeing, you know, Tony Kaye back with the Yes guys and so good on the keyboards. He had quite a basic keyboard setup for that, He had an OBX, he had two Hammonds and an electric piano. And so he had quite a basic setup. Then you went from Carry On to Make It Easy. Of course, we now know Make It Easy as the intro, to the live intro, well, for the Trevor Rabin lineup at least. It was the start of Make It Easy is known to Yes fans as the live intro to Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Yeah.
And of course, that's been released officially in different formats with Yes. That was really interesting. I don't know about you, Dave, but the thing that was amazing was that guitar work by Trevor Rabin at the start. I remember thinking, wow, no one's going to believe how fast this guy can play. If these guys ever play Yes tracks, he's going to have no problem playing the Steve Howe parts. But that was absolutely amazing. Make It Easy was such a great, powerful track. And I have to say, what we heard in the rehearsal studio was, I think, 10 times better than the recorded version that that's made it out there. It was so much more powerful, so much more energetic. And then basically the last song, full song that they played, was Chris Squire on lead vocals. And because obviously Carry On and Make It Easy, Trevor Rabin did the lead vocal. And then Open Your Doors was basically Chris Squire taking the lead. And that had Alan White playing Simmons drums for the whole thing. And
nice.
So you had, you know, Tony Kaye with this dun, 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 dun kind of piano and Alan... It kind of reminded me a bit of some of the early Frankie Goes to Hollywood sessions that Trevor Horn was producing.
Yeah.
Where they were kind of, it wasn't, you know, you just knew with Open Your Doors, if they had recorded that, that could have fitted in quite nicely, I think, on 90125, but got dropped in the, in the song selection process. But really interesting and a fantastic guitar solo from Trevor Rabin, but Chris Squire's lead vocals on that really were absolutely fantastic, and you know, his backing vocals on the other tracks were, you know, you could hear that kind of Yes kind of vibe with, you know, as soon as Chris Squire started doing those backing vocals, you know, it together with the rhythm section, you just knew this thing could head in the direction of Yes if it wanted to.
He really was taking the lead. You know, in Open Your Doors, Chris Squire was a powerful in bass and his vocals and the harmonies. So, you know, he was definitely a sort of right up there at the front and so leading the band. Everyone was looking at him, and he was, and Trevor, like you said, it was incredibly fast and precise and a bit of a shocker, really. We didn't expect a lot of that. But Chris was really leading the way.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about one thing that you mentioned when we were talking to Alan the other day. We were talking about the whole electronic drum kit situation, and we asked him if he would ever have thought of using an electronic kit, how sort of Bill Bruford did in the past, and he didn't seem too keen on doing it. But it's interesting that you mentioned that he used an electronic kit for a whole song during this rehearsal.
Yeah, look, you had the normal Ludwig kit that he had. That was this huge drum kit. I've never seen a drum kit that big that close up. But amongst that drum kit, you had a full Simmons electric drum kit as well. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who's heard the rehearsal tapes, you can hear him kind of tuning them up and getting them ready. But the entire song was electric, was the electric drums. But what was interesting, I think, was what we were seeing with cinema at that point. They'd already been in rehearsals for some time. They'd already improved quite a lot the original Trevor Rabin demos that had been done. They'd gone to a whole other level in the rehearsal rooms, you know, which was to be expected. You know, if you've got Chris Squire and Alan White on your rhythm section, you know it's going to go to a whole other level. But they'd really come together as a band, and they sounded incredibly strong. And I think that was the thing that was really interesting, was just how cohesive and strong they were. And as we said before, David and I for the whole of the rehearsal, we were allowed to go literally wherever we wanted to, because we had cameras in our hands and we were taking photographs. So we were allowed to literally go anywhere, and I just found myself coming back to Alan White's drum kit, because standing right next to him, the kit looked amazing, but we often forget just how amazing a drummer Alan White has been throughout his career. And I think if you look at that drama through to cinema, through to 90125, he was really at his peak then in terms of the really harder, rockier side of Alan's playing, as opposed to, say, Relayer, where he was more jazz kind of rock for that period. But this period, he was really on fire.
Yeah, definitely. Well, though, you mentioned, John, that you really liked that first song that they played, Carry On. David, did you have a favorite song that they played that time?
Do you know what? I mean, Carry On or Open Your Doors, or not particularly, but I think you had different impressions of different songs. What came across was how solid Alan and Chris were as a huge, solid outfit, and they were looking towards those two for sort of guidance, because Tony's the high part of the song there, and Trevor is really close to Chris and watching him, all those little nods and cues. So it was definitely those two and two others, sort of. That's the way I saw it. But as a unit, they were extremely tight. In fact, I don't know how long they'd been playing before that. You know, obviously extremely competent musicians. They may have just been doing that days or weeks, I don't know. But it was just spot on. It almost didn't matter what they played. It was too unbelievable to be there, and it was precise and loud.
So you guys knew the guys really well around that time period, and you were obviously talking with them quite a bit and stuff like that. What I've always been curious about is, was the plan for Cinema to always be a four-piece, or did they kind of quietly always kind of look for a fifth, for like a singer?
Well, I'm sure John will say something, but while we were there, to me, it was a fourth piece, but I think, obviously, if you read and look into the history, Chris was possibly the lead singer, then Trevor, the lead singer, looking for somebody to take that role, and Chris didn't want it, and Trevor didn't want to do that again after the Trevor Horn after the UK tour, as you know. So, and I think what became apparent to me as the whole session sort of became to an end, and I thought, this is incredible, the music's incredible, but do you know what? It is missing a singer and a lead singer. So I think, and you know what happened at the end, we'll speak about the people that came to visit on the day. But I think you could see that it was crying out for that. It couldn't have carried on as a four-piece and been successful as a, I don't believe anyway. It needed that voice, something distinctive.
Look, you know what, I actually do believe they could have been successful as a four-piece. I think if you look at Asia, you had your John Wetton equivalent with Trevor Rabin. Certainly Chris Squire was lead vocal material, but Chris always preferred to do backing vocals. And Chris was always looking for a lead singer. So I remember I used to know Trevor Horn quite well at the time and saw a lot of Trevor. And Trevor was asked to be the lead singer for Cinema. And in fact, he actually went to a few rehearsal sessions and sang with the band. But I remember having dinner once with Trevor, and he said, it was, at the time, Trevor said it was really tempting for him to kind of, because he was such a fan of Chris Squire and Alan White as a rhythm section. He said he was really tempted to sing with them. But he said to me that, I've done that lead singer role. I made a mistake in a way of joining Yes, because he felt that on a live stage, it's really hard to deliver those kind of high notes night after night. I think he'd been a bit scarred by the drama tour, where he'd managed to cope with the most of the American tour, but Chris kept telling him he had to sing at the same level that John Anderson did, and Trevor was trying to get for the drama tour. A lot of people aren't aware that Trevor was trying to get it brought down a key so he could sing it easier. And Chris kept saying, no, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And of course, that night after night, trying to sound like John Anderson, eventually got to Trevor by the time they got to the UK. So I think Trevor was a bit kind of scarred from that experience, and yeah. He didn't want to be the lead singer. And of course, what ended up happening was that you had Phil Carson invested a huge amount of money into cinema, and you know the recording sessions had cost a lot of money. And so I think it came down just to basic economics that it also made sense. By the time they'd been in the studio for a certain period of time, this was getting to sound more and more like Yes. And everyone knew that had been commercially successful. And so I think that was really behind the idea of getting John Anderson back in, was that so much money had been spent on the recording. And you just knew, as David said, if you added the Anderson voice to that, that was going to sound like something that had commercially worked before. But this time round, it was a lot more commercial, obviously, than what Yes had been previously. And Trevor Rabin had given the band a whole new direction, a whole new energy. And so the idea of putting that, you know, that extra magic ingredient of John Anderson's voice on top of that, as most people, I think, know with 90125, John didn't have a huge input to that. He changed a few lyrics. They changed a few things at the studio. But essentially, it was virtually recorded and done by the time John got on board. And I think it's better for it. You know, if you listen to the Paris sessions, that was Yes at its very weakest. And you went from, you know, that Roy Thomas Baker sessions to having had a version of Yes, get everything ready, get it absolutely perfect, rehearse to death, huge amount of time spent in rehearsal, a lot of time spent in the studio, which Yes hasn't done now for many years. And, you know, they were able to put together that killer album that bringing John Anderson in just made it a perfect album.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us a bit more about exactly how this worked then. So you say there was a lot of money invested in studio time in recording songs. Does that mean that there is cinema material out there which we haven't heard and some fairly well finished songs in existence? And also what happened, because didn't they start off with a different producer and then did Trevor Horn come in? How did all that work together?
Well, originally when David and I were there, they just kept talking about how Bob Ezrin had said this, Bob Ezrin had said that, and I think the original plan was that Bob Ezrin was going to produce it. Because
what he was a favourite, wasn't he? It was.
And I think once Trevor Horn had kind of decided not to do the vocal, then I think, you know, he kind of seemed to have pulled back briefly. Then they were talking to Bob Ezrin. And at that time, there was also a very strong consideration for the band not to be called Cinema. They were going to call the band Ice, which a lot of people aren't aware of. So the band originally was called Ice. And then I think someone else had that name. So they went to Cinema. And, you know, and then basically I think David, you might know more about that than me, but I think there was a few different bands called Cinema.
I think there was a few different bands called Cinema, and everybody agreed Cinema was good. And then the others suddenly disappeared with a paycheck, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, what was interesting, I think they all decided not to be Cinema, the other bands, quickly. So, yeah.
Well, you know, what was interesting was, you know, the question being about unreleased Cinema stuff, I heard about, seven Cinema tracks that I've heard that were fully done, you know, rehearsed by Cinema or produced by Trevor Horn. Because at that time, luckily, I was kind of, I was this kind of 18, 19 years old at that time. And for some reason, I got to meet Zeppelin, you know, Floyd, Yes, and got to know all these major bands. But Trevor Horn to me was a real inspiration. Watching him work in the studio as a kid at that age, I was just inspired by the guy. And we got on really well. And so I went to his house for dinner one night with Gary Langan, who had engineered Drama, and he was engineering, of course, what became eventually 90125. And so we went there, and Trevor basically played us tracks that were being, you know, had just been done in the studio, and they were preparing to give them to the record label. And they sounded absolutely amazing. There was one song which has been released called It's Over, which really did not appeal to me at all. That's just not Yes at all, and that obviously got dropped. But I heard earlier versions of Hold On. So I remember hearing a version of Hold On without John Anderson's vocals, where Trevor Horn's vocals on the chorus were really very prominent. And that was a fantastic version. The bass was more up in the mix. That was actually, for me, the best version I've heard of Hold On before John put his vocals on. And if you actually listen to the 90125 version, you can, if you listen really closely to the choruses, you can hear Trevor Horn's voice still in there. So there is actually one song that Yes did where you've got John Anderson and Trevor Horn both singing on the same track. That's the only one that that is really obvious.
Yeah.
And actually, Trevor once admitted to me that, yeah, and when I said, that's you on a Hold On, isn't it? You're doing the backing vocals. And he said, he just smiled and said, maybe. That was quite funny. But I also heard some pre-release versions of Changes and Hearts, and I can't remember what the other song
was. It Can Happen, wasn't there?
It Can Happen as well. That was the other one that obviously got officially released as well. And then I heard this long instrumental that everyone denies was, you know, they called in the Yes legend, it's, you know, this the big unreleased track that they never put out. It was a track called Time, and I do wonder if that was what I actually heard. So for people who don't know, there was the one track that did get released on 90125 is called Cinema. But yeah, apparently that is just the 2-minute intro to this really long track called Time. And I remember back, Relayer fanzine had commented on it, and I'd spoken to Alan White at the time during the rehearsals. And the first two tracks that they were kind of getting into in the studio was Time and also Changes, if I remember rightly. I think they were the first two they started to record. But you could already tell by the time they were working on Changes and Hearts, you know, because basically Hearts was a development of Tony Kaye's original keyboard, the intro, and that whole song was built up off Tony's original work in the studio that David and I heard. And if you hear the rehearsal tapes, you hear that song originally came from Tony Kaye.
Yeah, yeah, fantastic.
But I think there's a lot of unreleased material, I have to say. Yeah. So based on, you know, if you think about it, there is, at the very least, there's a version of 90125 without John Anderson. That is definite, because that went to the record label and
right,
heard it.
Yes.
As we all know, when it was suggested that, you know, well, you know, have you thought of talking to John Anderson? You know, Chris Squire basically talked to John on the phone. John was in, I think he'd been working in France, and they ended up sitting in Chris's car with Chris and John, and Chris played him what was 90125 without John Anderson's vocals. There was a few different lyrics on it, which John kind of yesified in his, you know, in the way that we all love. But there is a version of the album without John Anderson on it. And then you've also got a lot of the tracks that they had rejected. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a couple of hours of high quality material that has been recorded, because in that process, they'd spent so long in the studio, and they'd spent hundreds of thousands of pounds. And we are talking, you know, the start of the 1980s, where hundreds of thousands of pounds was like millions today.
Yeah.
And so there must be a lot of material that just hasn't seen the light of day yet.
Yeah. I don't know, when we spoke to Alan, he did say that he's got plenty of tapes, so perhaps they're amongst his collection, and one day we will see them.
So it's known that Trevor Rabin briefly tried out with Asia, but at the Cinema rehearsal, there was a discussion about another link between Cinema and Asia. What was that link?
Well, Nigel Luby, who was engineering the Cinema rehearsal, and I remember him telling me that the week before, they'd had a record company executive visit them at the rehearsal studio. I know they ended up with Atlantic, but I think they, from memory, they had a few different labels come through to check them out, because obviously, out of the Yes, at that point, everyone thought Yes had finished and had split into two groups. You were already had seen Asia go on to huge success, you know, way beyond what anyone expected. So as you can imagine, I think the reason they were able to get such a big budget was that, well, if this is half as successful as Asia, this is going to make a lot of money. And so this record company executive had visited them at the rehearsal studio, and Nigel told me that for fun, as this guy walked into the rehearsal studio, cinema played Asia's Heat of the Moment when he walked in. You know, just the apparently it was just the intro and you know the opening verse. Yeah. But this guy burst out laughing, but was obviously impressed. And I guess what they were trying to tell this guy was, hey, if they can have that hit, we can play that just as well as they can, and we can go to another level. So I think they were sending a very strong message to the labels that, hey, we want to be really successful with this, you know. So, yeah, and of course, you know, Trevor Rabin had actually played with Asia for a while before they settled on the four-piece lineup. So I think it was their way of telling the labels that they wanted a hit.
Fantastic. So, Dave, I'm going to ask you this question first, and then I'll ask John. Do you think, with the addition of a singer, because you've already said that, do you think cinema could have worked as a band and not turned itself into Yes? Do you think they would have had a future not playing Yes music in concert?
Well, obviously, me and John disagree probably for the first time in decades on this one, which is rare. But clearly, at the end, I thought this is tremendous and so powerful and so precise and not too, you know, too Yes-y. It was just a mixture, and I thought, but it is does require that extra. Mm. Now, I wasn't quite sure at the time, you know, where John was and what he was doing, but I just thought it needs something, just that something to tip it off. This is almost there, and then it would fly. That's the impression I got. I think John thinks they might have done well with that, but it was crying out, I think, for that, just that small, small northern bloke. Just that extra. And it, of course, all proved to be true as well, didn't it? I mean,
he
needed that, and it just flew.
So, but, I mean, had John joined, what do you think about cinema? Could cinema have been, you know, created as something different from Yes and not turn back into Yes?
I think the fans would have loved it, definitely. They would have embraced it. But I guess, like John just said, this was a time when you've had Asia, so they can see there's a huge amount of success just not too far away. They're good enough. They're the best of what they do. So. Yeah. You know, it was that they've seen it and they needed it and wanted it, and it was just that one small change.
Yeah, look, and I think what was interesting though was I think, you know, at the end of the day, if you were going to have a bunch of Yes guys together, it inevitably makes sense that, you know, if you're going to go live on tour, people have certain favorites that they're going to want to hear. So I could have imagined that, you know, Chris, if he'd had to step up, he could have easily done Roundabout. A cinema version of Roundabout with that energy that those guys had would have been pretty amazing. Mm. So I think there would have been a few Yes hits that they would have played, I think. But once John Anderson came back into the fold, you know, I think that was something that it was just inevitable that and made total sense for them to bring out the Yes catalogue. But what I think a lot of people don't know about cinema is how the band actually came together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mutt Lange, who for many years has been this, you know, I guess he's been the rock industry's version of Trevor Horn. You know, everything he touched has almost been a hit. Mm-hmm. And Mutt Lange played a really key role in bringing cinema together. So I remember Chris Squire saying to me back then that Mutt Lange had basically told him to work with Trevor Rabin because Trevor had been a session guitar player for Mutt Lange. And Mutt was very happy with the work that Trevor had been doing for him. And that is what directly led to Chris calling up Trevor Rabin and having that initial phone conversation with him. Basically, Mutt Lange had basically pestered Chris to do it. Now, Phil Carson, you know, any old Yes fan will know, Phil Carson was a manager at Atlantic Records who looked after Yes. And he was also friends with Mutt Lange. And so you also had on the what was the potential label side. Phil Carson basically knew Mutt, and Mutt had recommended Trevor Rabin to Phil Carson as well. So after Chris had that successful first chat with Trevor Rabin over the phone, Phil Carson arranged for Trevor Rabin to go over to London and to jam with Chris and Alan over there. Now, as Trevor Rabin has spoken about in previous interviews, those sessions weren't that great, but what they realized was they were all hungry to have a band where they could really put everything into it. And in my opinion, I think Trevor Rabin brought a lot more energy to the cinema sessions and a lot more focus than Jimmy Page had brought to the XYZ sessions. You know, I was listening to your podcast talking about the XYZ sessions. Just when you expect Jimmy Page to go and do a really fantastic lead guitar solo, it's like, where is it? You know, they were obviously backing tracks. Whereas with Trevor, I think he was really hungry for success. He'd had huge success in South Africa with Rabbit, and I think he wanted to replicate that success on a global basis. So he had a lot more focus on the lead guitar parts, the overall song outcomes, you know, and I think he was very happy to give Chris and Alan a real run for their money. And I think the as we saw with 90125, that energy and that drive between Chris and Alan and Trevor really drove that album.
I'm very curious about one thing. You said that Mutt Lange was very pleased with Trevor Rabin and the work that he had done with him as a session player. Now, I do know from reading some stuff in the past that Tony Kaye, for example, had done some stuff with Mutt Lange on some Def Leppard albums, sessioning on there. Now, is there anything that we might know of that Trevor Rabin played on that we might be familiar with?
Look, I'm not, but I think, you know, if you, but I mean, it's interesting, Trevor, when he lands somewhere, you know, at that point in his career was doing session work. So if you, for example, see it when you're with Trevor Horn, if you listen to the singer Seal, there's a track called Killer. And there's two versions of that. The one that ended up on the Seal album, that's actually Trevor Horn Trevor Rabin playing the guitar on that piece. And Trevor Rabin's been on a number of hits, but they've never actually kind of properly catalogued that. But that would be interesting to hear, wouldn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Certainly would. So, photographer extraordinaire, Dave, tell us about some of the photographs that you took and any other recollections you have of that event.
Yes, well, John managed to get a few in there with his smaller camera at the time, and I had this Nikon that I was trying out, which did a good job. But the key photograph out of all of those, which has been used officially by Yes, that one, I had to coax them all into that picture because they were all busy chatting, having a cup of tea. They finished just blaring out and blasting our ears. And then it was kind of, so I kept saying, come on guys, I need one more picture of all of you. And they kind of, oh really? Kind of go on then sort of thing. And Chris, last one to come along. No, come on, come in. You must come in slow. And I remember clearly saying, no, closer together, closer, closer. And look at the camera. And come on, give me a shot here. And so I had to coax that shot, which I'm proud of, because, you know, it was the only real one.
Yeah.
Of course, also, I remember going in there and John saying, oh, this is amazing, but hey, the tape machine's down there, okay? So the one that we managed to get the actual music from and the session.
Yeah.
Naughty John shouldn't have been doing that.
It was funny, at one point, Nigel Luby spotted the tape recorder at one point because I put he was the sound engineer, and I put it right near the his mixing desk because I thought he's going to mix to where that is.
Yeah.
So I had this quite a good quality tape recorder, and I put it there. And Nigel just turned around and looked at me and he said, what is that I spot, Mr. D? And then just had a smile on his face. And then he looked at me. and then it was like, don't worry, I'll let you put that one on. You know, so that was quite fun. I'm very glad Nigel didn't tell me to turn it off.
Yeah.
It was a sneaky moment. And if you remember at the end, of course, when we finally said our goodbyes and shook hands and thanked everyone, of course, what they said was, well, we've got the Atlantic executives coming in next, and they were literally turning up, you know, as we were leaving. So the big discussions were going to be happening. So that day, I remember clearly thinking, "Yeah, the big boys are here to see where this is going."
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, and they were certainly ready for it. I mean, that's the one thing I think if we, for David and I, there's absolute agreement that these guys were absolutely ready. They were totally at the top of the game.
Mm.
And, I mean, what you hear on the bootleg really is, it was nothing compared to what it was like.
It's a 10, isn't it? It's a 10 out of 100 instead of a, yeah.
Yeah, and what was interesting too is I did have Yes Management ask me for the best quality copy that they could have of that rehearsal. So I actually went through all my old tapes, found the original tape, and last year got a digital copy made of the original tape and sent that through to Yes Management. Mm-hmm. So it would be lovely to have a proper release, I think, from Yes Management. If they could get all the agreements up, it was a hard thing to get that done. I've done that kind of work. You know, there is the definitive version of 90125 has definitely not come out yet.
Yeah.
And it would be great to see the rehearsal come out properly mastered and all those tracks that Trevor Horn produced that never saw the light of day.
Yes, yes.
You know, it would be great to see a definitive version of that album.
Like a box set.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Trevor Horn, of course, has the track record for doing this kind of thing with his return trip to fly from here. So perhaps he will get round to doing that one day.
And wouldn't we all like to hear that Chris Squire bass that we heard on that stage?
Oh, yeah.
And those different sounds that he had wound up to 10, 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, wouldn't we like to hear that again? Mm-hmm. And his vocal.
Yeah.
Okay, so away from this rehearsal event, John, I understand that you attended Gigi and Alan White's wedding reception at their then English home in the summer of 1982. Now, that was just after Chris and Alan had finished the XYZ sessions and they had already begun working on the cinema tracks. So which Yes people turned up?
Well, that was, I was really amazed to be invited to that wedding. You can imagine I was only 18, so suddenly being invited your favorite drummer's wedding reception was kind of slightly blew me away. So I remember he was in Oxfordshire at the time and I was living in Shropshire. And so it took me ages to get there on the train. And so in addition to Alan White, you had Yes Wise, you had Trevor Horn there. Tony Kaye was there, of course, now well-known Yes person, Trevor Rabin was there.
Mm.
And Chris Squire was there as well. And on top of that, I remember my favorite memory was basically I was talking to someone and actually Jim Halley, who was then had been in the management for Yes at Brian Lane's office.
Oh.
And I was talking to him and then suddenly I felt someone kind of pulling on my sleeve of my shirt going, Hey John. And I was thinking like, I'm in the middle of talking to someone. Who is this? You know, who's pulling my arm? And then it was realized it was Alan, and he goes, John, got to introduce you to Jimmy Page. Jimmy, this is John. And it was right, okay, that was worth stopping that other conversation. And then Jimmy said, can I give you my address so you can send me your Yes magazine? And so I ended up Jimmy Page giving me his address because he wanted a copy of the magazine. And then we went off and had a drink together. And I was only 18, so, you know, hearing every word coming out of Jimmy Page's mouth, you know, I just hung in there and just drank way too much than I should have done. And my one memory was, because, you know, it was my main exam the next day. And so I was so having so much fun hanging out with the Yes guys, talking to Jimmy Page, getting way too drunk, that I missed the last train. So I ended up having to go home on the milk train, ended up being late for the exam, turned up to the exam drunk, and so drunk that actually I couldn't start the exam. And they came up to me and they said, are you okay? Because they could tell I was drunk. And I said, can I borrow a pen, please? You know, I was so drunk, I couldn't figure out how to start the exam. And then I realized because I needed a pen. So, you know, so that was, it was a great party. You know, you had all the, as a young 18-year-old boy, you know, there was Gigi White used to be a model, you know, so all her model friends were there, all looking very glamorous and gorgeous. And around Alan White's, Alan's house was this old mill that was just amazing. It was all done up. and the you know, and it still had the mill wheel inside the house, you know, and nice. In his garden you had all these Roger Dean stage props. So for a Yes fan, you know, you had these Yes guys, lots of alcohol, Roger Dean stage props. It was pretty amazing, you know. So and of course all the well known like Nunu Whiting, you know, Alan's drum tech. Richard, yep. Who was the tech for Chris. There was a lot of familiar Yes faces around there. Mm. And even though I was only 18, what has always been lovely about Yes is when they welcome you into the Yes family, they really welcome you in. And The fact that, you know, I'd only met Alan, I think, a year before properly. And the fact he invited me along, I think, was a sign of how nice a guy Alan White is. He's a really, really nice man. And so were all the other guys, you know. That was a very special moment. I'll have to try and find some of the wedding reception photos and send them along to you.
That'd be great. Well, just before you go, though, that experience obviously spurred you on to other great things. So in 1989, as I mentioned right at the start of the interview, you started Rock Aid Armenia to help the victims of the Armenian earthquake. And you managed to get Chris Squire and Jeff Downes onto your all-star remake of Smoke on the Water, which I've heard and it's great. So who else was on that song? And it did rather well, didn't it? Wasn't it a hit?
Yeah, it was actually. So what was fun for me is I decided basically to... I got the first foreign film footage out of the Armenian earthquake zone. Mm. And so I got to see a lot of the footage that was, you know, it was really, really awful. It couldn't go and be shown on TV. And I thought, well... You know, thanks to my, this is end of 1988 now, going into early 1989. And I thought, well, thanks to Yes, I got to meet all of these bands, you know, all the really big bands, Zeppelin, Floyd, Queen, and everyone else. And I thought, well, there's no reason why I couldn't pretend. I should try and get them together, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, at that time, I was, 24, 25. And so I thought, well, I know I can get Chris Squire. And I'd love to get Chris and Jeff back together because I love Drama. It's my favorite Yes album. Mm. And so I thought, well, I reckon I can get Chris and Jeff together, but I've got to get other people, you know, who I can get definitely get a record deal with. So I thought, I called up David Gilmour from Pink Floyd and he said yes straight away. And I said, can I use your name? And he said yes. And so I then called Brian May from Queen and he said yes. And I thought, well, this is definitely happening now. So I know at the very least I've got Gilmour, I've got May, I've got Squire, and I'll get Downes. And so then I thought, oh, well, I love Rush, so I'll go and get in touch with Neil Peart. Oh. And so Neil said yes. And and so he was the original drummer. And right. So basically we did five sessions, and unfortunately I had to move the first session at the very last second. And that meant Neil Peart couldn't come over to do it because, you know, they were going to, I think, doing some live gigs with Rush. So it was, and Neil, you know, so miss him. He wrote me the loveliest letter in a fax and handwrote it and sent it across about how much he'd been looking forward to playing with Chris Squire, who's his hero, and playing with Gilmour and May. And, you know, so I had the loveliest letter, you know, so he was as sad about it as I was. So basically, you know, in the end, we ended up on guitar, had Richie Blackmore, of course, who wrote the original riff. We had Alex Lifeson from Rush on there, Tony Iommi, who was just the loveliest man ever. Mm. And 30 years on, he's still supporting the Rock Aid Armenia project. Mm. David Gilmour. And of course, Brian May. And, you know, Brian, you know, did a video for us late last year, you know, for the project, you know, so he's still been supportive. Then on vocals, we had Ian Gillan, who's still involved with the project and has been over to Armenia with us with Jeff Downes. So, you know, we've had musicians like Jeff Downes, Ian Gillan, Tony Iommi come all the way to Armenia, to the earthquake zone and help out, and still doing it 30 years later, you know. And so... So we had Ian Gillan on vocals, Bruce Dickinson did the second verse, Paul Rogers from Bad Company and Free did the third verse, and then we were lucky enough that, you know, Brian Adams popped in just when he had a number one hit with Everything I Do in God knows how many countries.
Yeah, yeah.
He walked into the studio, even I was overawed, right? Because Brian was like so huge, and I said to Ian Gillan, Ian, I can't do it. You go and ask him, you know. And he said, ask him what? I said, well. just ask him to do backing vocals. Just do the Smoke on the Water chorus with you, you know. And so I had luckily I had the film crew there. And so we got Ryan doing that. And then we had Keith Emerson on keyboards. I managed to get Keith, who was lovely. And of course, Jeff on doing all the Hammond. All the Hammond on that record is Jeff. He did stunning work. Uh-huh. And then basically, because Neil couldn't do it, I then spoke to Brian and I said, Brian May, and I said, look, is there any chance you can get, you know, Roger? Can Roger step in? And so thankfully, Roger Taylor from Queen stepped up. And so we ended up having the very first session, you know, so if you look at the main rhythm track that we had for this, it was actually Queen and Yes. So you had Brian May and Roger Taylor on, you know, the main riff and drums, and Brian basically overdubbed someone else. We had a session guy come in because 4 days before the actual first recording, Brian May went and broke his arm. And but the main rhythm section that we had was, in the end, was Chris Squire on bass, yeah. Roger Taylor on drums, Brian May on guitar, and of course Jeff on Hammond. And yes, that version of Smoke just really rocks. Yeah, and then and then we eventually added everybody else on top of it, but that was nice. That was, if you think back to the early days, Queen once supported Yes, they did. The early days, so this was kind of bringing them back together again. And that was so it was a lot of fun. Rocket in Mania, we had a top 40 hit with that, and I'm glad to say that we then relaunched the whole Smoke on the Water with the 2010 remix that I did, and with my close friend Ara Tadavosian, who I run Rock 8 Armenia with, he's the guy on the ground in Armenia. We actually took Jeff Danz to Armenia. Jeff and I got the Order of Honor because Jeff and I were the only people who were at every single session for the Rock 8 Armenia project.
Right.
And we were given the Order of Honor, which is Armenia's highest honor from the President of Armenia.
Yeah.
And we went and saw this school that was dilapidated. It hadn't been properly rebuilt. And so, you know, Jeff, Ian Gillan, Tony Omi, myself and Ara, we thought this place needs knocking down and we need to build a proper music school. So I'm very glad to tell you that after years of fundraising, we ended up building this really beautiful school, which currently teaches music to 220 kids every single year. And it's a beautiful school. It's, you know, so we had money from the record. Ian and Tony released an album and a single. They were amazing. I have to take my hat off to Gillan and Naomi. Are just the nicest men. You know, they've been the backbone of the project. And we've got this school in the earthquake zone that is, you know, teaching music to this day, and will be teaching music long after we're gone. So the whole Rocket in Mania project, it's 30 years. It's kind of wound down now. But we had a big 30th anniversary get together last year in Armenia, in the capital Yerevan. And but you know, that would not have happened without Yes. So if I hadn't done that Yes Music magazine, and then through Yes met all those people, there wouldn't be a music school in Armenia today. So Yes, I've got to thank the band because they took me in, were really nice to me, and that whole Rock 8 Armenia project absolutely would not have happened without Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, listen, it's been absolutely brilliant to speak to you, and so many fantastic stories and anecdotes and connections that we've heard about tonight. So I just want to say thank you so much, John and Dave, for giving up your time to come and speak to us on the podcast.
And, you know, the great thing is I got to meet David Wilkinson. We all know he's the number one Yes fan out there. So it's thanks to everything. Thanks to you, Dave, as well, for everything you've done. Cheers, mate.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, John. It's very kind of you.